First of all, I want to join in with Tom and express how good it is to see everyone, be able to be back together, at least in this circumstance, and it will only be getting better and returning back to normal, hopefully, as the next few weeks go on. Our plan, and Jared and I have discussed this, I think our plan for the immediate next few weeks is we're going to continue the online Bible studies. So the Sunday morning lesson and the Wednesday evening lesson, we'll continue to do those online for a few more weeks, but our goal is to get away from that and get back to our regular meeting here at the church building for all that we do. I told Jared a couple weeks ago that it's just really strange preaching into a camera every week and teaching into a camera. I'm not used to that. Jared has said in his videos that he's not, you know, easy sitting down, so he's gone to standing up doing his videos. It's a good trick. I need to maybe copy that one. My fear is that I'm going to get so used to preaching to the camera and teaching the Bible class that way that when we come back together, I won't know what to do. But it's another adjustment we'll have to make. But it's good to see everybody here. Good to see everybody doing well. Of course, we want to remember those of our number who are not with us today. Think about John Hurst and others who are not able to be out. And so keep everybody in your prayers. But it certainly is encouraging and wonderful to see everybody doing so well this morning. For our lesson this morning, I'd like for us to think about a story that is recorded in the Gospel of Mark. If you have your New Testament and want to turn to the Gospel of Mark, we're going to eventually wind up in chapter 10, but we're not going to begin there. As you're turning to Mark chapter 10, I would remind you of a story that occurs a long, long time before Jesus came to the earth. It's recorded in Genesis chapter 12. Where God said to Abram to leave his homeland, to leave his country and his father's house, and go to the land that I will show you. And so Abraham left. We're told in the book of Hebrews, chapter 11, that Abraham left, not knowing where he was going, but simply following God. And one of the things I think that the Bible is trying to get across to us is that following God and being a person of faith like Abraham was, is like going on a journey. It is like leaving one place and going to another. It is like leaving your home. It is like leaving everything that you are familiar with and going into a far country, going into a strange land where things are very, very different. It is not by accident that God calls Abraham to go into a different place. That is what being a follower of God is like, that God calls us out of the world and he calls us into his kingdom. He calls us out of the lives that we've been living into a life with him. And as we make that journey and we make that transition, just as it was with Abraham, everything seems strange to us at first. Because the way that God wants us to think, the way that God wants us to view things is very different from the way that we have learned to think and view things from our former lives. However, like Abraham, the longer that we stay in God's place, the less strange it becomes to us. We learn as we go, as it were, and the new becomes even more familiar, and the old life that we used to live in the old place fades from our memories. That's exactly what we find as we read the story of Abraham, that it wasn't a smooth transition, that it kind of starts off in fits and starts, as it were. Abraham stumbles a couple times, doesn't quite understand. But by the end of his story, he has settled into this new life in this new place with God. Abraham was not the only person who had to go on a kind of spiritual journey, as it were. the 12 men that Jesus called to be his apostles had to do a similar thing. That Jesus called them to leave behind the lives that they had been living, to leave behind their nets and their boats at the Sea of Galilee, to leave behind the tax collector's office where Matthew had been sitting, and to follow him into a new life, into a new way of thinking. And as we look at their experience this morning, I'd like for us to think about something that I think may help us as we follow in those same kinds of footsteps. As we think about the disciples and what it was like for them to be called by Jesus, in Mark chapter 3, we hear about how Jesus called his disciples. So we're going to kind of take a running start at our topic this morning in Mark chapter 3. And in Mark chapter 3 there, we read in verse 13 that he went up on the mountain and he summoned those whom he himself wanted, and they came to him, and he appointed 12 that they would be with him and that he could send them out to preach and have authority to cast out demons. And the author goes on to give us the names of these 12 men. And so from that point onward, they have left their former lives, and now they're going to follow Jesus throughout the rest of this story. And what we find immediately after that, in chapter 4, is that they heard Jesus teach in parables. There's every indication in the Gospels that this is how Jesus began his ministry. Not with the harsh criticisms and the deeper lessons, but with the parables, with the easier things to understand. And so Jesus taught in parables in Mark chapter 4, and yet we are told, not surprisingly, that these 12 men really did not understand what Jesus was talking about. The fact is that, according to the Gospels, most people did not understand what Jesus was talking about. It says there in verse 10 of that text that as soon as he was alone, his followers, along with the 12, began asking him about the parables. What did you mean, Jesus, when you said that the kingdom of God is like a man sowing seed? And he said to them in verse 13, "Do you not understand this parable?" And he goes on to tell them, now I'm going to explain this to you. To you it has been given to understand the mystery of the kingdom of God, but there are some who are never going to get it. And I need to make sure that you do. But he says to them in verse 13, "Do you not understand this parable?" But Jesus is not being harsh with them here. He is not scolding them or rebuking them, because it is very early in their training, and Jesus understood that this would be kind of foreign to them. And so the story goes on, and in the next episode, chapter 4, verses 35 through 41, you remember that they are on the Sea of Galilee in the evening, and the storm came up. And we are told that Jesus was asleep in the back of the boat, and the storm was raging. It says a fierce gale of wind came. The waves were breaking up over the side of the boat. The boat is beginning to fill up with water. And they woke up Jesus and said, "Jesus, don't you care that we're perishing?" And Jesus got up and rebuked the wind and said to the sea, "Hush, be still." And the wind died down and it became perfectly calm. And he said to them, "Why are you afraid? How is it that you have no faith?" And the only reaction that they could muster is that they were afraid. That what in the world just happened here? That I've never heard of anything or seen anything like this, that a man could say to the wind, "Stop," and it stops. And yet, again, we see in the narrative that they really haven't caught on yet. But again, it is still kind of early in the story. There's a lot that they have to unlearn and then learn about Jesus in the process. But you'll notice that Jesus is prodding them. He's saying, "Listen, guys, I'm expecting you to get this, that we're not in the world that you used to be in, that you're now through a different portal here, and things are different now. You need to open your eyes." And so the story goes on. And in Mark chapter 5, they saw him heal people. And then in chapter 6, they were with Jesus when he fed the 5,000. And then right after that, you remember that they got into the boat and they went back toward Capernaum. And this is the occasion when Jesus walked on the water. And you remember the details of that story there in Mark chapter 6 and in the other Gospels, that it was at night and the wind is against them. Here they are again on the sea in kind of a difficult situation. And Jesus came to them in verse 48, walking on the sea. And in verse 49, they thought it was a ghost and they cried out and they were terrified in verse 50. And Jesus came to them and said, "It's okay, men, it's me, don't be afraid." And he got into the boat with them. And again, like it had a couple chapters earlier, immediately everything was calm. And they again were utterly astonished. And notice what Mark tells us about this. Why were they astonished? And that's a good question. Because they had seen Jesus do something on the sea before. They had seen him calm the sea with his word just a couple chapters ago. And so here they are again. What in the world is going on? And Mark says the problem is that they had not gained any insight from the incident of the loaves, but their heart was hardened. They hadn't learned anything yet. And it is clear from the narrator here that the narrator thinks that they should have been picking up on this by now, but they weren't. But the story goes on. They saw him heal more people in verses 53 through 56. Then in chapter 7, they heard him speak about the Pharisees. And this is part of the education of these men, because I think in some ways the Pharisees, to a lot of people, represented a kind of genuine piety. That the Pharisees represented people who were really trying to do the will of God, who were serious about this. These were religious men. And Jesus tried to tell his disciples and everybody else that they're not. That they are hypocrites. They are pretenders. That beneath that veneer of religiosity lies some pretty evil stuff. And so Jesus warned them here in chapter 7 about the Pharisees. Remember that here in chapter 7 that they were criticizing Jesus and his disciples because they had not washed their hands before they ate. And Jesus said to them in verse 6 that rightly did Isaiah prophesy of you hypocrites. And he pointed out their thinking and what was wrong with it. And yet, the disciples still weren't getting it. Later on, Jesus or the disciples came and they were kind of confused. What did you mean, Jesus, when you were talking to the Pharisees? It doesn't make any sense. And Jesus says to them in verse 18, "Are you so lacking in understanding also? Don't you understand that whatever goes into the man from the outside cannot defile him, because it does not go into his heart, but into his stomach, and it's the things that go into your heart that make you impure." And they didn't get it. The story goes on. They go up into the Gentile territory, and they see Jesus healing foreigners up there. And then they are with him on another occasion after that, in which Jesus feeds another great multitude of people. He feeds 4,000 people on this occasion. And he again warns them about the Pharisees. Be careful about these people. And then in verse 14, we read that as they were leaving that confrontation, they began to discuss with one another the fact that nobody had brought any food to eat. And Jesus said, "Why do you discuss the fact that you have no bread? Do you not see or understand? Do you have a hardened heart? Having eyes, do you not see? Having ears, do you not hear?" And Jesus is alluding there to some passages in the Old Testament that talk about idolatry and the kind of people that worship. And Jesus saying, are you just like them? Are you telling me you've learned nothing, that you can see nothing, that you understand nothing of what is going on? Do you not remember when I broke the 5 loaves for the 5,000, how many baskets full of broken pieces you picked up? And they said, well, yeah, it was 12. When I broke the 7 for the 4,000, how many large baskets full of broken pieces did you pick up? And they said, 7. And he said to them, so you don't understand? You don't get it? Do you not see that this is not about physical food? It's about the spiritual food that I provide in abundance for you. But no, they didn't get it. They did not understand. And I think that one of the things that might have been kind of frustrating about this whole thing is that I'm sure that they thought they did understand. If you go back to Mark chapter 4, look at what it says there in verse 38. This is where Jesus calmed the storm at sea. Jesus was asleep on the cushion in the back of the boat, and they woke him up and said, "Teacher, do you not care that we are perishing?" Now, that is a perfectly natural reaction if you are a person without faith in Jesus, right? If you don't understand and don't know who Jesus is, that's a perfectly good reaction. Jesus, come on, this is a situation, you need to be part of this. I'm sure they thought that that's the right thing to say and do on this occasion. In Mark chapter 6 and in verse 35, the disciples came to Jesus and said, this place is desolate, it's quite late, send the multitude away so that they can go into the surrounding countryside and villages and buy themselves something to eat. Again, a perfectly logical way of thinking if you don't know who Jesus is. Look down in verse 49 of that same chapter. They saw Jesus walking on the sea, and they supposed that they were looking at a ghost. And they cried out. What else are they supposed to think if they don't know who Jesus is? In chapter 8 and in verse 4, the disciples said, here at the feeding of the 4,000, where will anyone be able to find enough bread here in this desolate place to satisfy these people? Now, what's amazing about that is that they had already seen Jesus feed 5,000 people. And here we have a situation that is almost exactly the same, and their reaction is, I don't know what we're going to do. And I'm sure that to them things didn't make sense, that their thinking was correct and something else was wrong with the situation. And as we look at them say these things and we look at Jesus talk to them, we get this clear picture that, of course, these men had to make a transition. They had to learn. They had to graduate. You know, the word graduate literally means to take a step. That there are gradations. And as you graduate, you take a step from one to... They had to take some steps. And stop looking at things as they are outwardly. Stop thinking in terms only of the literal and the physical and look to the spiritual. And this was hard for them to do. It's hard for anybody to do. It's hard to change the way that we think. It's hard to change the way that we look at everything because we get used to seeing and thinking a certain way, and that's just the way we do it. And changing that is difficult. It was difficult for these men because Jesus was introducing to them a new way to think. A new way to view the world, a new way to look at their lives and their situation and even themselves. It was a complete reorientation of everything. And you know, the problem with reorienting yourself is that you have to get disoriented in the process. If you think you're facing north, but you're not. You ever done that? You may be driving along or going someplace and you think you're going in the right direction, but you're not. And you have to get this kind of thing out of your head and understand that, no, this is not north, you know, that kind of thing. That's what's going on here. Their compass is kind of scrambled. And then we come in Mark chapter 8 to a moment of change. In Mark chapter 8, in verse 22, they came to Bethsaida. And they brought a man to Jesus and implored him to touch him. And taking the blind man by the hand, he brought him out of the village. And after spitting on his eyes and laying his hands on him, he asked him, "Do you see anything?" And he looked up and said, "I see men. I see them like trees walking around." He didn't see everything clearly. He could make some things out. "I see these things, that they're like trees, but they don't have definition. I don't see that with clarity, but I see these objects, these dark things moving around in my vision." And again, in verse 25, Jesus laid his hands on his eyes, and he looked intently, and he was restored, and began to see everything clearly. Notice that. He looked intently. That he had to focus. That Jesus had opened his eyes. But he needed to concentrate, as it were, on what it was that he was now seeing. Because he had gone from not seeing to seeing. And he had to think. He had to learn to process what it was that was in front of him. And it says, and he looked intently and was restored. And then he began to see everything clearly. This is an interesting miracle. Because his sight does not come back to him all at once. And there have been a lot of things written about this miracle. Is there something wrong with Jesus? Could he not heal the man? And the answer to that is no, there's nothing wrong with Jesus. There's nothing wrong with Jesus' power. That like all the other miracles in the Gospels, this miracle is meant to be an illustration of something. It's meant to illustrate a spiritual truth. And I think in this context, it is going to illustrate here what has to happen to the disciples. That they have to start looking intently. They have to start focusing. They have to start concentrating if they're going to see clearly. And so when the man finally does get his focus and he can see all things clearly, then notice what Jesus says in verse 26, "Don't go back into that village." He took him out of the village and healed him outside and said, "Now don't go back into there." Why? Because that's where the blindness was. "I've taken you out of there. I've brought you into a new situation. There you could not see. Here you can. Stay out of there. Stay here." He made a journey. Like Abraham had to make a journey from Ur of the Chaldees to the land that God brought him. Like the disciples were making a journey in their understanding. So this man made a journey, as it were. Jesus took him out of the village, and outside of the village, he comes to see, and Jesus says, "Now this is where you need to stay." And this man becomes a spiritual symbol, not only of the 12 disciples, but of what it means to follow Jesus in general. I want you to notice what happens from this point forward in the narrative. In the very next scene, Peter confesses Jesus. Remember, Jesus said, who do people say that I am? And they got all these answers. And then Jesus says, "But who do you say that I am?" And Peter said, "You're the Christ. You're the Messiah. You are the promised one of Israel." And Jesus said, "Peter, you got it. Yes, that's correct." And immediately, as Peter came to this conclusion, it says in verse 31 that he began to teach them from that moment on that he must die. He tells them that, "Yes, I am the Messiah, Peter, and that means that I've got to die, because that's what the Messiah is supposed to do. And not only am I going to die, Jesus goes on to talk in verses 34 and following that if anyone would come after me, he must deny himself and take up his cross and follow me. That this cross is not just something for me, it is something that all of my disciples have to pick up and carry as well. And this is, of course, a major step for the disciples in understanding Jesus. That he's not just another Jew. He's not just another rabbi. Now they understand that he is the Messiah. And Jesus says, okay, now we have to get used to the idea that I'm going to die because that's what the Messiah will do. And then from that point on, there are several lessons in the narrative about what it means to be a follower of Jesus. The next thing that happens is the transfiguration. Now that Peter understands that Jesus is the Messiah, now that these 12 men have heard that Jesus is going to die, Jesus says, now the thing that will happen after that is that I will enter into glory. And Jesus showed them a preview of his glory. At least he showed it to Peter, James, and John in Mark chapter 9 there. And you recall what it says there in verse 9, that as they were coming down from the mountain, having seen Jesus in his glory, that he gave them orders not to tell anybody what they had seen until the Son of Man rose from the dead. In other words, don't you talk about my glory until I have died, because my death has to happen before I can be glorified. And Jesus is trying to get them to see that sequence of events. Then in chapter 9, verses 14 through 29, we have this story where some of Jesus' disciples could not cast out a demon. And they said, we brought him to your disciples, but they could not cast it out in verse 18. And Jesus then casts it out. And as I've spoken on other occasions, I think what's going on here is that the disciples have begun to think of themselves perhaps a little too highly. That they think that because Jesus has empowered them, that the power is in them. And when they try to do something on their own, it doesn't work. And Jesus has to remind them that no, in verse 23, it's possible only if you believe. That it's your connection with me that makes this possible. Then the disciples have their usual argument about who is the greatest, and Jesus says, well, the one of you that is most like a little child is the greatest. And then there is this scene where in verse 38, teacher, we saw someone casting out demons in your name, and we told them to stop because he's not one of us. Jesus said, no, we're not doing that. He's not the enemy. We're not in competition with that person. And I don't want you thinking that because you're my disciple and he's not, that you're somehow over him and that you can tell him. We need to love everybody. He who is not against you is for you. That's followed up by a story about the Pharisees in which Jesus talks about divorce. The Pharisees come up testing Jesus about whether it's lawful for a man to divorce his wife. And of course, the Pharisaic practice had no consideration at all for the woman. If the Pharisee wanted to divorce his wife, he would get rid of her for somebody else. And Jesus' point is, there's no love among them. That this cannot be what God is talking about because this lacks love. And he shows them that that is not God's intention. What God intended in verse 9 is for this husband and wife to be together in love. We then have another story about Jesus blessing little children. And then we have the story about the rich young ruler who trusted in himself that he was righteous until Jesus showed him that you're really not. And then we have this discussion among the disciples where they were, again, arguing about who is the greatest. James and John came up to Jesus and said, we want to be on your right hand and on your left when you sit in your glory. And Jesus says, Well, what it takes to get to glory is to go through the cross. Are you able to drink the cup that I am able, that I must drink? It's the same lesson as the transfiguration, that the glory only comes after the cross. And through these series of episodes, Jesus was trying to tell his disciples, this is what life is going to be like for you now. That this is the way that you are going to be living. That yes, glory does await you, but it lies in your relationship with me, in your humility, and in your love for other people. That's the kind of life to which I am calling you. Not the life like the Pharisees live, not the way that you think according to the world. You've got to get that out of your thinking. You can't think like the rich young ruler or any of these things. That you've got to come to grips with these kinds of things if you're going to be my follower. And the whole thing ends with the story that we've been kind of aiming at all morning here, and that is Mark 10, verses 46 through 52. They came to Jericho, the last stop on the way to Jerusalem. And he was leaving Jericho with his disciples and a crowd, and a blind beggar named Bartimaeus, the son of Timaeus, was sitting by the road. In the previous story, there was a rich man that came to Jesus, but Bartimaeus is a poor man because he is blind. He is a beggar. And whereas the rich man could see with his eyes, but he couldn't see the flaw in himself, here we have a man who can't see with his eyes, but he understands that there is a problem within himself. And he calls out in verse 47, Jesus, Son of David, have mercy on me. Notice that he calls Jesus the Son of David. And he calls him that again in verse 48. The Son of David is the Messiah. He is the King. This man has faith. He is addressing Jesus with his royal title, that he is kind of, in a way, making the confession that Peter made, that you are the Christ. And he comes to Jesus, and Jesus says, what is it that you want? He says, I want to see. I want to regain my sight. And Jesus said, go, your faith has made you well. And immediately he regained his sight. He doesn't go through this process of seeing men like trees and having to focus. His sight comes to him immediately. Why? What's the point? What's the difference? Well, it says here that Jesus said, your faith is what has done it. Your faith has made you well. And that is exactly the point that Jesus has been trying to get across to the 12 disciples. Peter, you said you believe in me. And it is that is going to be the life that you live from now on. A life of humility. A life of taking up your cross. A life of love for other people. That's what it means to believe in me. And if you can believe in me, then you will gain your sight. You will come to see. You will come to know. You will enter fully into the new world. And you will be the new person I want you to be. You see, this blind man kind of represents what the disciples needed to be. Whereas the other blind man represented what the disciples actually were, kind of gradually coming to sight, Jesus is here showing that this is what it really looks like. When you become a person of faith in Jesus, then you can see, then you know, then you can understand. And so let me close this morning with just a few lessons that I think all of this perhaps has for us. See, like the disciples, like the blind man in Mark chapter 8, that we have to come to see. We have to grow. We have to come to understand Jesus. And simply knowing what happened is not enough. The disciples had been with Jesus ever since Mark chapter 3. They could tell you all the things that they had seen, and yet we saw throughout the narrative that over and over again they didn't understand. Knowing what happened, knowing the facts, just simply knowing the stories is not enough. You remember back there in Mark chapter 8 that Jesus touched the man and then his eyes were fully opened. This man here in Mark 10 has faith in Jesus. And for lack of a better term, what I think the text is trying to get across to us is that we need to cultivate a personal relationship with Jesus. Now, I don't like to use that term. It's a perfectly legitimate term. But that term has been so abused by people out in the world, a personal relationship with Jesus, that it has come to mean some kind of shallow emotional reaction about Jesus, as if, you know, my emotions are the key to my salvation. You know that I'm not saying that this morning. I'm talking about a real personal relationship with Jesus, where he is a friend that you talk to on a regular basis like you talk to your friends, that you listen to what he has to say, that you think about him, that his words ring in your ears, that he has influenced the way that you live and you think and you act. That kind of relationship. That's what the disciples needed. They were friends with Jesus. They hung around Jesus, but it's not until they became believers in Jesus that they really became disciples. Like the blind man needed the touch of Jesus and the disciples needed faith, so you and I must come to this point in our lives to trust Jesus, to believe in him, or as the Apostle Paul would say, to know him. In Galatians chapter 4, Paul says this to the Galatians in verse 8, "At that time, before you were Christians, when you did not know God, but you were slaves to those things that are by nature no gods, but now that you have come to know God, or rather to be known by God, then why are you turning back again to those weak and worthless elemental things?" You have come to know God, and God has come to know you. That you have a relationship now. It's not just that you're aware of God's existence. It's more than that. That you have come into a relationship with God through Jesus Christ. And we're never going to be able to live in this world and see and understand until that happens within us. Faith in Jesus is the key to the whole thing. You remember the blind man here in Mark 10, Jesus, son of David. You remember Peter's confession, "You are the Christ." You remember in John chapter 6, "Lord, to whom shall we go? You are the one that has the words of eternal life." You know, sometimes people ask, "Well, my faith has waned. My faith is kind of diminished. It's not what it used to be. How do I increase my faith? How do I get my faith back again? How do I get it strong again?" And the answer is, you get your faith strong again in exactly the same way you got your faith in the first place, by going back to who Jesus is, that he is the Son of David, he is the Son of God, he is the Messiah of Israel, he is the one who has the words of eternal life, and there is nobody else that can do that for us. And once we are drawn to Jesus because of that, and we put our trust in him because of that, that's where our lives really begin. Like it was with the disciples, like it was with Abraham, it requires that we leave our old ways of thinking behind us, that we come out of the darkness in which we used to live and come into a new way of seeing, a new way of understanding everything. In the book of Ephesians, this is exactly how Paul talks about conversion in chapter 4. "I affirm together with the Lord that you no longer walk just like the Gentiles walk, in the futility of their mind, being darkened in their understanding, excluded from the life of God because of the ignorance that is in them, because of the hardness of their heart." Paul's saying, now that you're a Christian, you can't do that anymore. You've got to leave that old world of darkness and ignorance and hardness behind. Become one who trusts in Jesus, who has this relationship with him, and let your life start all over again. As it was for the disciples, so it will be for us. This is a process, not necessarily an event, but it's not a process that has to take forever. It's not a process that has to take all of your life. That like the blind man in Mark chapter 10, we can come to that moment of awakening. We can come to that moment of seeing if we have faith in Jesus. And so the exhortation this morning is for us to become people with that kind of faith so that we can become the kind of people that the Lord truly wants us to be in this world.